Well, thank you very much. Is the microphone working? No? Why is it not working? I have turned it on. Is it working?
Yeah.
Okay. So it's an honor and a pleasure to be the last speaker of this remarkable conference on mathematical physics and geometric analysis. Actually, maybe I should say, for those of us who have been at banquet now, we know that this is not the actual name of the conference. This is just a pretext for a much more important event. Of course, I'm talking about the Geometric Institute workshop. So, anyway, whatever the title of the conference, I think on behalf of all the speakers and all the participants, we should thank the organizers and the Fields Institute staff for hospitality and the wonderful conference. Okay, so the goal of this talk will be to try to give you a bit of a flavor of how mirror symmetry would work when we go beyond the Calabi-Yau case. I will say a lot of fancy words, but basically this is a propaganda talk where I'm going to try to explain some conjectures and give some very easy examples. And, well, we'll see how far I get, but let's try to keep this, fairly low-key and easy. So the usual setting for mirror symmetry is that of Calabi-Yau manifolds. So a Calabi-Yau manifold is just a Kähler manifold together with a holomorphic volume form on it. So that requires the canonical bundle, that means the bundle of holomorphic N0 forms, to be trivial. And so then you can choose a holomorphic volume form. So for example, on Cn with a standard Kähler structure, I could choose dZ1 wedge dZn. And now mirror symmetry is the belief, following from conjectures in string theory, that there should be some fundamental duality among Calabi-Yaus, where whenever you have some object in symplectic geometry of a Calabi-Yau, you should be able to see it, to see another object in the complex geometry of a mirror Calabi-Yau. And then whatever calculation you might want to do on one side would have some converse on the other side. So I've put here some buzzwords, which I will not bother to try to define or justify. But the interesting feature, therefore, is that the complex geometry data on one Calabi-Yau, so the complex structure and the holomorphic volume form, should go into determining the symplectic form of the mirror, and vice versa. So, initially, there were these examples around, and it wasn't clear how you would construct a pair of mirror manifolds. And the first insight into that, I think, came from the Strominger-Yau-Zaslow conjecture more than 10 years ago. And it's been subsequently refined by various people, Konsevich, Seubelmann, Gross, Siebert, Fukaya, various others. I'm only mentioning mathematicians, so if there's physicists in the audience, you should just know I'm not mentioning them just because I'm not completely competent to know what happened there. So anyway, the geometric intuition should be that X and X dual should carry dual vibrations by special Lagrangian tori. So we should have this idea that there's a real manifold of real dimension equal to the complex dimensions of these Kähler manifolds, such that when I take special Lagrangian torus vibrations over it in two different ways that are mutually dual, I will end up getting a mirror pair of Calabi-Yau manifolds. And of course, there's a lot of fine print, and the fine print says that basically this doesn't quite work as advertised, but roughly speaking, this is at least a good first-order approximation. So my goal will be to try to explain what the analog should be in the more general case where you don't assume your manifold to be Calabi-Yau. So the generalization that one needs to incorporate into this setting is that the mirror of a non-Calabi-Yau manifold is what physicists call a Landau-Ginzburg model. And for mathematicians, that just means, well, a non-compact manifold M equipped with a holomorphic complex-valued function called W, the superpotential Fernando Ginzburg model. And roughly speaking, this function W encodes the obstruction to things being Kaledi-Yau. In particular, it measures, as we'll see later, it measures failure of Fleur theory for Lagrangian submanifolds in X to be well-defined. So, roughly speaking, the prediction of mirror symmetry in this context is that when we have a Kähler manifold in a suitable class, I will explain what I mean by that, we should be able to find a Landau Ginzburg mirror, and then the simplistic geometry of X should relate with a complex geometry, not quite of M, but actually of the critical locus of W, of the singularity, it's really complex singularity theory for the critical points of W. And conversely, the complex geometry of X should relate to the simplistic geometry of M, well, not quite in the usual sense, but relatively to a level set of W. And so examples of predictions of mirror symmetry in this formulation are, for example, just to give a couple of examples, the quantum cohomology of X, which encodes pseudo-holomorphic spheres in X, counts them in suitable ways, should be related to something that has to do with the complex geometry of the superpotential W, namely the Jacobian ring, which is you take the ring of functions on M and you quotient by the ideal generated by partial derivatives of the superpotential. So the multiplicative structures are meant to be the same. Another prediction, if you care more about the complex geometry of X, well, you can look at the derived category of coherent sheaves on X. So that's one of the fundamental objects in algebraic geometry. And Kontsevich's homological mirror symmetry says normally this should be equivalent to a Fouquier category on the mirror, so a category built out of Lagrangian submanifolds and Fleur homology. Well, the way we need to modify these things here is actually we need to consider not necessarily compact Lagrangian submanifolds, but also submanifolds that have a boundary in a fiber of W. So you fix a fiber of W and you do Fleur theory for Lagrangians relative to the fiber. So I probably won't get to say more about how the geometric predictions that I'm going to make relate to this, but you know, if you want to get an idea of what it means to be a mirror, these are target things to try to prove. So of course the big question is how do we construct this mirror? So one case where things are very well known, and that's essentially thanks to the works of Horry and Waffer in physics, but also at the same time, you know, all the mathematicians who studied toric mirror symmetries, Batyrev, Giffenthal, many others. So anyway, it's quite well understood in this case how to take a mirror and why various things work. So for example, the prediction I mentioned about quantum cohomology, or the predictions about derived categories of coherent sheaves, are known thanks to works of, Batyrev for quantum cohomology, and Abu Zaid more recently for derived categories. Okay, so what's the mirror of the toric manifold? Well, the answer is it's C star to Bn. Okay, C star to Bn is always the same. Where we are going to see more interesting things that depend on which toric manifold we started with is in this superpotential W. So W will always be a Laurent polynomial. And just to give you an example, my favorite toric manifold, it should be yours as well, but I can't really force you, is CP2. So CP2 as a toric manifold, well, simplistically, the moment polytope is just, I'm always tempted to say an equilateral triangle, but I think it's only in affine geometry that this guy is equilateral. And its mirror, well, will be C star squared with a superpotential that's of the form Z1 plus Z2 plus a constant over Z1, Z2. And the constant depends on essentially the side length of this moment polytope. So, you know, if you do calculations, you will see that this superpotential has three critical points, and you can analyze lots of things, and it works very well. The general formula, there's an explicit formula that involves a sum of terms. There's one term for each facet of a moment polytope, and the exponents in there are precisely the normal vectors. So that's why here we get Z1, Z2, and constant over Z1, Z2. And then the constant terms in front of these are, well, they depend on the actual constant terms in the equations of the facets. So how do we go beyond the toric case? So here's a rough conjecture. It's not particularly original. I don't really know where it came from. Certainly people like Horry and Panksiewicz were aware of the general ideas, if not of all the details. So the general conjecture is that if we have, so the input we should have should be a compact scalar manifold and within it a complex hypersurface that represents the anti-canonical class. So if you want the first chunk class of a manifold. And of course that's a constraint on the class of manifolds I can take mirrors of. But I don't see how to go beyond that, at least at the moment. So now if I have such a divisor, so I can let it be smooth or normal crossing, or I'm not completely sure what the general setting would be, but certainly normal crossing is fine. So now on the complement of D, I can find a holomorphic volume form, which has of course poles along D. And I'm going to come back to that, so don't worry if this is a bit scary. I mean, the goal of the talk is to explain this, basically. So the mirror will be built by looking at a moduli space of special Lagrangian tori in the complement of D. So I'll have to explain to you that there's a way to define the notion of special Lagrangian in this setting. And actually, I will be looking at special Lagrangian tori together with local systems on them, if you want flat unitary connections on the trivial bundle over your Lagrangian. So, and then, so that's the manifold. And then the superpotential is supposed to count holomorphic disks of Maslow index 2 in X with boundary in your given Lagrangian. So when you have a Lagrangian torus, you can look for holomorphic disks with boundary on it, try to count them in a suitable way. I will explain how exactly what I mean. And that will give you some quantity. It will be a complex number because I will put some coefficients in front of each disk. And actually this appears also in the work of Fukaya, Ota, and Ono as what they call the M0 obstruction to Fleur homology. And another interesting feature is the fiber of W is actually meant to be mirror to the divisor D that you chose. Okay, so that's the rough idea.
Same thing as you were showing previously, is the case
toric
variety?
Well, I'm going to get to that. Don't worry. But actually, I mean, I have two examples only, and one of them is toric varieties. Okay, so before I show you how it works, I should first say that the conjecture doesn't quite hold as stated. So there's various problems with that. One that's actually quite obvious if you've tried to look at curve counting invariants is that this quantity is not well defined. I mean, well, even because, you know, even before I tell you what coefficients I want to use, the counts of holomorphic disks depend on extra choices. And depending on which choices I make, I will get different numbers. So in fact, there's wall crossing discontinuities in this definition. And what I need to do is I need to, what's called instanton correct or quantum correct the mirror, so that actually this count starts making sense. And so in a way, what the quantum world is saying is that this guy should take precedence over this guy. We should abandon, in some places, the idea that we strictly take a moduli space of special Lagrangians, and instead we should take something on which this will be well defined, whatever it ends up being. So I will try to show an example of that. And the other thing is that, according to Horry and Vaffa, well, the mirror that we get out of this is too small. We need to enlarge it by a procedure that they call renormalization, and we'll see concretely how that works in the toric case. Okay, so the plan is going to be to try to explain what this stuff is about. Any questions at this point? No? Okay, so let's start with special Lagrangians. So, this slide is suspiciously empty. Well, we'll see. So let's say that I have a compact scalar manifold to dimension n, and I choose a section of the anticanonical bundle, which means that if I look at its zero set D, on the complement, I take the inverse of the section that defines for me an N0 form with poles along D. And then I will say that a submanifold of dimension N in X minus D is special Lagrangian if, well, first it has to be Lagrangian, and second, the imaginary part of big omega has to be trivial on it. Okay, so if you want, when you restrict capital omega, it's a complex valued N form, you restrict it to L, you want to get a real valued N form. Okay, so, well, the definition is a very simple generalization of the Calabi-Yau case. The only difference here with the Calabi-Yau case is that this guy has poles, and in particular, it's not of norm, it's not of constant norm with respect to the Kaelor metric. But still, well, the results of MacLean still extend to this case, and they tell us that special Lagrangian deformations are in one-to-one correspondence with harmonic one-forms on your Lagrangian. So that means, in particular, in correspondence with the first cohomology of your Lagrangian submanifold. And deformations are unobstructed. That means you can actually always carry out these infinitesimal deformations and get honest special Lagrangians nearby. So, more precisely, just so that I have, you know, an actual math argument in there, rather than just speculation. So, the harmonic forms that we look at are one forms on L, which are closed, and co-closed after multiplication by a scaling factor psi, which is the ratio between the volume forms determined by the holomorphic form and by the Kaelor metric on the Lagrangian. So you can redo classical Hodge theory with this factor of psi in there. If you're smart, you realize that in dimensions other than 2, that's the same as a conformal rescaling of a metric. In dimension 2, it isn't. And what you see is that, so a small deformation of a submanifold, that's a section of a normal bundle, it's a normal vector field. And the normal vector field is special Lagrangian deformation. By the Cartan formula, you do a small calculation, you see, well, if you have a normal vector field, you can get out of it a one form by putting it into the symplectic form and restricting to the Lagrangian submanifold. You can also get an n minus one form by doing the same thing, but putting it into the imaginary part of big omega. And this one form and this n minus one form on L are related by the Hodge-Star operator. And being special Lagrangian means that you want both of these to be closed. So that's why it works. Okay, so I should take this opportunity to mention that in particular, so if I have special Lagrangian tori, well, each one of the torus has dimension n, so these come in n-dimensional family. And if I'm lucky, I will get locally a fibration by parallel copies of my special Lagrangian torus. Now, the base of such a fibration, so the parameter space for my family, has two natural affine structures. Because its tangent space, the tangent space to, if you want, the tangent space to the moduli space of special Lagrangians, can be identified well with H1 of L, just by looking at the cohomology class of the closed one form, or with Hn minus 1 by looking at the cohomology class of the n minus 1 form. So if you want, you know, this class here corresponds to the flux of omega when I move to a nearby special Lagrangian, and that one there corresponds to the flux of the imaginary part of big omega. And somehow, mirror symmetry can be thought of as a transformation of affine manifolds with two affine structures that exchanges the affine structure from complex geometry and the affine structure from symplectic geometry. So that's a slogan, for example, in Gross and Siebert's approach to mirror symmetry. Okay, so let's look at the case of toric manifolds to make this concrete. So if I have a smooth toric manifold with, so I will call phi the moment map, I'm sure in this room I don't need to explain to people that there's something called the moment polytope, which is the image of the moment map. And if you take the boundary of a moment polytope, then what sits above it, it's a toric divisor, well, it's actually the union of all the points where the action is not free. So for example, you know, this would be CP2 blown up in one point, and the union of these four CP1s gives me an anticanonical divisor. And in fact, one other way, you know, when you talk to complex geometers, you can tell them that the toric manifold is a compactification of C star to the n by adding suitable divisors. the complement of D is biholomorphic to C star to the N, but of course the simplistic geometry is more interesting. And so on that you can take a holomorphic volume form, which is just the product of a D log xi, the standard holomorphic volume form on C star to the N. So now it's quite easy to see the toric fibers, so the Tn orbits, are just going to be special Lagrangian. They are Lagrangian by classical symplectic geometry, and they are special just by the fact that they are products of circles here, and then you can see that, well, this is going to be, actually there's a slight lag, sorry. I should modify everything by a factor of e to the I and pi over 2 all over the place. So it's sometimes the real part, sometimes the imaginary part of my form but 0, but it doesn't matter. Okay, so now if I look at these two affine structures on the base, so on the parameter space of my toric orbits, well, you see that symplectic geometry tells us the base of the moment map vibration is the moment polytope. And that reflects the fact that there's a finite amount of symplectic volume in my manifold. On the other hand, the complex geometry doesn't see that. The base for the other affine structure is just going to be all of Rn. And in fact, the projection would be the log map, which takes z1, zn to, oh, sorry, this should be called x, I guess, but whatever, the logs of the norms of the coordinates. And that's why you see the same pictures in toric geometry and in tropical geometry, but some of them are finite, some of them are infinite. Okay. Now, here's a non-toric example. And that's just here to show you that, in fact, finding explicit special Lagrangian vibrations is much easier in the non-Calabi-Yau case. In the Calabi-Yau case, it's a really hard problem to get any kind of non-trivial example. Well, this one is not so impressive, but, you know, one can actually find a lot of interesting examples. So, my non-toric manifold, my favorite non-toric manifold is also CP2. And I will still use the standard Taylor form, because that's easy, but now I will change my anticanonical divisor and my holomorphic 2 form. So if you write it, you know, in coordinate in C2 in an affine chart, the toric guy would be dx dy over xy, and it's defined on the complement of the two coordinate axes and the line at infinity. And I'm going to modify it to dx dy over xy minus epsilon for some constant epsilon. So that means my divisor, I've actually smoothed one of these points. So schematically, CP2 in the toric case might look like this, and my non-toric CP2 might look like that. Somehow I've smoothed a corner. I could smooth more corners, but then I don't have an explicit nice formula to give you. So I claim that I can find a family of special Lagrangian tori in this, explicitly. How would I do that? So I'm going to use the map which takes xy to the product xy. So if you think about it for a second, this is a conic bundle. Okay, the fiber above a non-zero point is just going to be what I would call a hyperbola, xy equals constant. And the fiber above the origin is the union of the two coordinate axes. So now inside there, let's look at the following guy. Oh, sorry. So first of all, I should say there's a circle action on this, which is compatible with this map and also compatible with the data I have. And that would be the key, of course, to doing things. Namely, I can multiply x by e to the I theta and y with e to the minus I theta. So circle action with weights 1, negative 1. So now I can look for S1 invariant special Lagrangian tori. And I claim I can build them as follows. So first of all, I fix a radius, and I take a circle centered at epsilon in the base. And then I take the preimage of that, and in there, I look at inside each fiber. So each fiber has somehow a waist, the circle on which norm x equals norm y. And I look at the circle that has symplectic area lambda between the equator and it. Another way to say it, well, actually probably easier for you guys, take the moment map for this S1 action and look at the guys where the moment map level is equal to lambda. well, up to some 2 pi factor. Okay, so that will give me a torus. It's easy to see that it's Lagrangian, essentially that's the fact that norm of this thing, Poisson commutes with the Hamiltonian vector field of the S1 action. And it's easy to see that it's special by an explicit calculation. So these things are all smooth with one exception. The guy that's singular is the one where the radius is chosen so that my circle passes through the origin and lambda is zero. Then my torus gets pinched as it goes through this point. So in fact, if I were to look at the base of my fibration, I would draw it as something that has 2 corners because I still have things near infinity, but I've smoothed out the corner that I had here, and in exchange, I've added a singular fiber in my affine structure. And somehow I have to make a cut if I want to think of it as an affine manifold. And in fact, this boundary is straight with respect to the affine structures. It's bent by the monotomy of this singularity. Sorry, this is not being clear. It's not needed for the rest of the talk. It won't be on the exam. Okay. So in particular, just to introduce some terminology, if the radius of my circle here is bigger than epsilon, so then I enclose the origin, and that essentially things are slightly off-center, but they look a lot like product tori. So for my purposes, for the purposes of Fleur theory, they behave like standard product tori. On the other hand, if the radius is less than epsilon, so if they look like this, then they behave quite differently from the point of view of holomorphic curves. And in fact, the prototype of these guys is what's known as the Chekhanov torus, which was constructed by Chekhanov. It's an example of a non-standard monotone Lagrangian torus in CP2. And you can just take it by definition to be one of these things for a suitable choice of the radius and for lambda equals zero. Okay, so these are examples of special Lagrangian torus vibrations. So now let's go back to trying to construct a mirror. So the definition for my candidate mirror, as I've tried to announce, is that I will take a space of pairs consisting of a special Lagrangian torus in X minus D and a flat U1 connection on the trivial line bundle over L up to gauge. Okay, so I only care actually about the holonomy of my connection. So in particular, if I fix my torus L, the space of such connections is again a torus. In a way, it's a dual torus. And that's where we're starting to see this duality of torus vibrations. So the geometry of this guy M is very interesting. You can equip it with a lot of geometric structures. So just to explain the complex structure carefully, well, what's the tangent space to M at a given point, L nabla? So to deform the pair L nabla, I have 2 choices. I can deform L or I can deform the connection. To deform L, I need a normal vector field with the property that when I plug it into, say, the symplectic form, I get one of these harmonic one-forms. To deform the connection, I need to add a one-form to the connection. And that one-form should be closed so that the connection stays flat. But if I add something that's exact, it doesn't matter. It's a gauge transformation. So, in fact, I'm looking just at cohomology classes, and I can choose my favorite form in the cohomology class. Let's take the harmonic one. So now that tells me that the tangent space to M is actually just the complexified space of harmonic forms. Okay. And that gives me naturally an almost complex structure on it, just because the tangent space is naturally a complex vector space. And in fact, the amazing property is that this complex structure is actually integrable all the time. One way to see that is to construct some holomorphic functions on it. Just to give you an example of holomorphic functions that will be useful to me later, let's say that I choose a relative homology class. Okay, so what do I want to do? Let's say that I have a Lagrangian submanifold L, and I choose some class in relative H2, and, well, now I can associate to it 2 quantities. One is its symplectic area, that's well defined independently of how I homotopy it or which representative I choose. And the other one is the holonomy of a flat connection along the boundary, seen just as a homology class in each one of them. Now if I combine the two, so for me the holonomy of the connection will be a unitary complex number. Okay, it's maybe the exponential of what you would call the holonomy, if you want. But it's in the unit circle. And I multiply that by exponential of minus the symplectic area, well, that gives me a non-zero complex number. And it's easy to check that this guy is a holomorphic function. It's only defined locally, of course, because to make it a function, I need to keep track of beta as I move my Lagrangian. So locally, I can always do that. But globally, there might be monodromy, but, you know, when I go along a loop of Lagrangian submanifolds, it comes back to a different class. But anyway, I have local holomorphic functions. That gives me a complex structure. Now, there's also a Kähler form on it, which is built out of the other guy, out of a complex volume N form. And there's a holomorphic volume form, if you really care, which is built out of a symplectic form. So, you know, we fit the requirements that the complex data comes out of the symplectic form on my initial space, and the Kähler form on the mirror comes out of the complex data on my initial space. Okay. Now, next. Let's get to serious things. So we have a space, it's a complex manifold, we want to define a holomorphic function on it. So how do we do that? Well, we want to count holomorphic disks with boundary in a given Lagrangian submanifold. So first of all, what do we know? Well, it's known that if you look at the moduli space of holomorphic maps from the disk to a symplectic manifold with boundary in a Lagrangian submanifold, then this is a well-posed problem, and you can associate to it a moduli space that in good cases, assuming transversality, will have real dimension n minus 3 plus the Maslow index of the class beta that you chose. Now, I'm not going to define the Maslow index, I'm just going to characterize it by an easy property in our case. The Maslow index in our case is equal to twice the intersection number between this class beta and the divisor D. Okay, so Maslow index 0 corresponds to disks that stay in the complement of D. Maslow index 2 corresponds to disks that hit D once. Maslow index negative 2 doesn't occur because a holomorphic disk has to intersect a complex divisor positively. So the good news for us in terms of technical assumptions for Fleur homology is we have nothing with negative Maslow index. Let's assume for a moment that things are even better. We don't have any non-constant disks with Maslow index 0. So that means no disks in the complement of D. And let's assume, moreover, that Maslow index 2 disks, so the next guys, are actually regular. So they come in families of the correct dimension, and we can count them in a sensible manner. So these assumptions are very strong. As far as I can tell, the only case where they always hold for all your special Lagrangians is the toric case. So, but in the toric case, at least, we can make sense of this. And I'll explain later, if there's time, how to remove part of the assumption. So now, what do we do? Well, let's look at, you know, the smallest disks we have, those of Maslow index 2. So how many of them are there? Well, the virtual dimension formula tells you they should come in families of dimension n minus 3 plus 2, that's n minus 1. And if you think that, if you remember that the boundary of each disk is a loop on your Lagrangian, that means if you look at all the points on all of the boundaries of these disks, that forms an n cycle on the Lagrangian. So you should be able to count disks passing through a given point on the Lagrangian. You should be able to get a finite number. So in this case, under these assumptions, indeed, you can count how many disks pass through a generic given point of the Lagrangian, you get an integer, and that integer does not depend on the chosen point or auxiliary data. So now what will be my definition for the superpotential? So at a point L nabla of M, I will take the quantity which is obtained by summing over all the classes of Maslow index 2, the number of disks in that class, times a weight coefficient, z sub beta, which is none other than my holomorphic function from the previous slide. Okay, so essentially, you know, ignoring holonomies, I'm weighting disks by e to the minus their area. By the way, these quantities are always bounded by 1, because the symplectic area of the holomorphic disk is always positive. So by construction, this quantity is holomorphic as long as the sum converges. And I don't have any general result, but at least in the Fano case, convergence is fine, and even in non-Fano cases, experimentally, you seem to be in good shape, at least in examples I've seen. Okay, so let's look at the toric case. So the toric case has been worked out in detail in a 2003 paper of Cho and Ho in slightly different language. And actually, there's an earlier paper of Horry that somehow lays out the foundations and explains how this should work on simple examples. So let's say again that we have a smooth toric manifold with moment map, polytope. We again take our divisor to be just the union of all the boundary strata. And we take the standard holomorphic volume form. And as I've mentioned before, the toric orbits are going to be special Lagrangian tori. So now, what about the mirror? Well, I've said the complex structure on the mirror comes from the symplectic geometry, and in particular the flux on my moduli space of special Lagrangians. So that means I take my base, which was symplectically the moment polytope, and complex-wise the entire Rn, and I'm going to flip the two interpretations. So I'm going to look at a toric vibration where the complex geometry, so the log map, corresponds to the moment polytope, and on the other hand, the symplectic geometry, the flux and the action coordinates, are unbounded. So what that gives me is something that's biholomorphic to a bounded domain in C star to the n, namely where I require the norms of, well, log norms of the coordinates to lie inside the moment polytope. And on the other hand, on this bounded domain of C star to the n, I will put a complete Kaelor metric that blows up near the boundary so that actually it has infinite volume near the boundary. Now, that's not quite what we were expecting, but it's not too far from it. Now, as I said before, there are no Maslow index zero disks. Well, why is that? So Maslow index zero means that you're staying away from your divisor. So that means you're staying in the main toric stratum, C star to the N. Well, it's pretty clear that you don't have disks in C star to the N bounded with boundary on a product of circles. It's maximum principle. And moreover, so what about Maslow index two disks? Well, Maslow index two disks hit the toric divisor once, and so they have to choose which of the toric, you know, which of the facets they will hit. So in fact, there's one family of such disks for each facet, and you can write it down explicitly in coordinates. And you can check it's regular, and you can figure out how to count it, and what you will end up with is exactly this formula that was on the first slide, telling you what the superpotential should be. It is a Laurent polynomial with one monomial for each facet. And so essentially, these terms all come from the weight given, you know, they all come from the area of these disks. The counting coefficient is just 1, and so therefore it's not here. So for example, let's look at CP2 again. So in CP2, well, let's look at C2 inside CP2, and in there, let's look at a product of two circles of radius R1 and R2. So what kinds of Maslow index 2 disks does it bound? Well, there's some obvious ones. One is you take a disk of radius R1 in the first coordinate axis times a point in the second one. The second one is you do the converse, and the third one is left to your imagination, knowing that CP2 actually has three homogeneous coordinates. And now if you count their contributions, you will find, well, Z1, Z2, almost by definition, are the variables associated to these classes. And that guy, the third one, ends up being that one, because its area is always the area of CP1 minus the sum of the areas of the first two. So that's how it works. Now, in fact, well, our mirror is smaller than what was expected. So we need to explain maybe how to enlarge it. And, well, that's a part of things that's a bit more hazy, so certainly more work will be needed to understand why we need to do that, what it means, what it stands for, and so on. But so the idea is to enlarge M, well, we might want to think about inflating the symplectic form of our toric manifold along the divisor D. In fact, even in the non-toric case, we can do that. We can add something supported, we can add a form supported near D to our symplectic form to somehow create more room around D. So we can switch to a new symplectic form, which is in the cohomology class, class of omega plus k times the first charm class, where k will tend to infinity. And the main requirement here is that x must be Fano, otherwise this class might not be ample, or even, actually, you might be able still to do it in the case where this guy is semi-positive. But certainly you can't always do it. So in the toric case, what that corresponds to is you just enlarge your moment polytope by amount of k in each direction. Just give yourself more space. And in a way, that creates more special Lagrangians. And what happens to the superpotential? Well, each disk suddenly has acquired area k more. So the corresponding count is scaled by e to the minus k. Well, you just multiply by e to the k, and then you can make sense of this limit. Somehow, the various mirrors you get for various values of k all sit within each other, like Russian dolls, and you can just take a limit, which will be a complete guy. So possibly the geometric intuition for why we need to do that is we need to try to flow the Kaylor metric on x minus d towards a Ricci flat one or something like that. But I'm really hazy on that, so I'm just explaining at least how one can get all of C star to the n. If you do that here, you will get the classical C star to the n.
So, this is a good question, but how do you know that getting all of C star to the n is like the right answer and not...
It's very far from clear. There's very little telling us that it should be one or the other. So that's why I'm saying I don't really know if we need to do that. It certainly helps with some technical issues at some other stages in checking other predictions. So that seems to be quite good. On the other hand, it's pretty clear, you know, so the formula up here works even if your toric manifold is not Fano. And if you try to do that, say, for some Hilbert surfaces, and you just complete brutally to C star to the N, well, you just get the wrong answer. The answer that you got before completing is much better. But, you know, these are not Fano. So I don't really know. The honest answer is, I don't know. If you just mention it as a possibility. I have complete faith in Cantor also. And, you know, if he says it must be done, then. Okay, so now what about the non-toric case? How will we handle issues? You know, first of all, what's going wrong, and how do we handle it? So, the main problem in counting disks is bubbling. And concretely, in our situation where we try to count disks of Maslow index 2, the only way that bubbling can occur is if in a family of Maslow index 2 disks, suddenly we lose a Maslow index 0 component. And then, as we try to push past that, well, this guy will disappear, and this guy will disappear. We'll only be left with a disk in a smaller class, still of Maslow index 2, but with lower symplectic area. And of course, to complicate things, well, unfortunately, Maslow index 0 disks can easily be multiply covered, or this can happen in several points of boundary at the same time. So it's quite delicate to understand what's going on and how to count things properly. But what's sure is that the count here and the count here are different. So typically, the way in which this happens in dimension 3 or more, this happens already if you have a single Lagrangian, but if you change your choice of which point you want to impose that the boundary of the disk has to pass through. In dimension 2, well, you're lucky somehow, it's a borderline case, the disk count does not depend on which point on the Lagrangian you want your disk to pass through. However, it does jump when you move your Lagrangian to a nearby Lagrangian submanifold. So there are walls in the moduli space of Lagrangians that delimit chambers in which you have different disk counts. And so that makes your formula that was above that was in the previous slide, that makes it discontinuous because the count of disks jumps. In higher dimensions, it's a bit similar, except you have somehow a chamber structure already within choices for a given Lagrangian, so it's actually multi-valued, and the jumps can be realized, you know, and the various chambers somehow overlap. So what's going to save us is that actually the wall crossing behavior has been analyzed very carefully. So there's well hidden inside the 1200-page manuscript of Fukuya Ohota Ono, with a little bit of reinterpretation, there's actually a formula for what kind of jumps happen. And in our language, the claim is, so I'm giving you the two-dimensional case. I don't actually understand the higher dimensional case. In dimension two, when you cross a wall, an elementary wall somehow, when there's only one simple Maslow index zero disk, so the elementary jump will modify your superpotential in a certain way. And interestingly, the change will be by a holomorphic change of variables on the domain. So what you have to do is you replace each variable z beta by z beta times some power series in z alpha, where these z alphas and z betas, sorry, I erased them, that's exponential of minus the area times the holonomy on the boundary. So concretely, these are all holomorphic coordinates on M, and what we do is we do a change of coordinates on M. We precompose our holomorphic function with a change of coordinates. That's a very, very strange operation when you think about it, because it means in particular that the critical points are not well defined, but the critical values are well defined. They stay the same. So the standing conjecture, and it seems to be justified by calculations and examples. I don't think I will have time to get to examples of that. But what seems to make a lot of sense is to actually forget the idea that the mirror should be M as it was defined before. Instead, we should take the various pieces of M that we got delimited by these walls, and we should glue the various regions together using these formulas. And that gives us a new complex manifold on which, by construction, W will be well-defined and holomorphic. So the catch here is that these formulas, well, they're holomorphic, but they're not symplectomorphisms for my omega dual. So the answer is, at the moment, I understand quite well how to view the mirror as a complex manifold. I don't understand nearly as well how to view it as a symplectic manifold. And that's probably because I understand better the symplectic geometry of what I started with than its complex geometry. It could be that renormalization actually helps there. Something that needs to be checked. It could be that this renormalization thing that was there before actually helps with this issue. Okay, anyway, so back to my example of my favorite non-toric manifold. So again, we take CP2 with the holomorphic form dx dy over xy minus epsilon, and we still have our favorite family of special Lagrangian tori. So they look like this. In this map, xy goes to xy. One of them is singular when we pass through the origin. So I said before that standard tori and Chekhanov tori behave differently when it comes to Fleur theory and holomorphic disks. Concretely, where do we see wall crossing? Well, we see wall crossing exactly when the radius of a circle becomes equal to epsilon. So then what happens, you know, use your imagination and move this guy so that it sits inside this singular fiber. So you get a circle in the union of the two coordinate axes. Well, what kind of disk does a circle bound in the union of two planes? Well, just take a circle in whichever of the two planes contains it. You know, so that disk is actually a Maslow index zero disk. It doesn't hit D, and that's the exceptional guy that will cause things to jump. So if you analyze carefully how that's going to happen, you can try to count families of disks bounded by this tori in various cases. So in the standard case, when the radius is more than epsilon, you end up, so I'm not telling you what my variables correspond to, but they correspond to various homotopy classes, beta, that I will leave to your imagination. Well, in this case, they're just the same homotopy classes as when you started from a product torus and you deform to this guy, which is not quite a product. and you get the usual formula. If you're on the other side for chicken of Torrey, so guys that look like this one, you get another formula. There's a paper of Chekhanov and Schlenk where they compute families of holomorphic disks bounded by the Chekhanov torus, and they find that, I mean, so it's kind of strange because the conventional wisdom was the usual standard torus bounds three families of disks, the Chekhanov torus bounds two families of disks only. Well, actually it bounds five families of disks. So it was quite good that they did the calculation carefully. And just condensing things, so you know, if you expand this thing, you will get various monomials. So if you compute things carefully, you get this kind of expression when you count them with my favorite coefficients, where the variables U and V, well, they correspond again to some homotopy classes. I mean, the one disk that's easy to see is a trivial section. You know, you take this filling disk here in the base, and you somehow lift it in the vibration. But the others are much harder to see. So now, these two formulas look very different. But the first place where you start having faith in all this is if you try to compute, you know, use multivariable calculus to compute the critical values of these two functions. And you find that they're the same. That's a piece of good news. And in fact, so, you know, to understand how these two sets of variables, Z1, Z2, and UV on the mirror, so you have two coordinate charts to see how they relate to each other. Well, geometrically, what you would do is you would just try to pass through the wall and keep track of your favorite homotopy classes. And what you find is that this guy that I've put here as V is Z2 over Z1. But the guy that I called U, so I said U is a trivial section above that, well, it gets to be either Z1 or Z2, depending on whether I pass above or below the singular point. And that's where I see the monodromy of my family. The fact that somehow I can't keep track of the same homotopy class all around the singular torus. So now if you try to glue these two formulas together using these formulas, you end up with a mess. I mean, already you end up with a mess, you know, with at least a small headache if you try to incorporate this case-by-case thing. But what you can observe is that if instead, so V will stay Z2 over Z1, but if you try to use the wall crossing analysis to guess what U should be, well, you will find that U should be Z1 plus Z2, regardless of whether I'm above or below. You get the same formula for U, so you somehow annihilated the inconsistency that came from monotomy. And if you plug these guys into here, you will end up with that guy. So you've made your superpotential continuous, well-defined, at the same time as you made the mirror well-defined and smooth. So it's pretty clear that the correct mirror should be this one. Okay. Well, I think at this point I should probably stop here and let you imagine where one might go from there. Well, so I can find it in various cases that I've looked at. And in principle, you know, one should always be able to find some change of variables just by using this proposition. So this is only the case of complex dimension 2. Now, how to actually find it explicitly? Well, I don't know if I have a general method. Certainly, I can do it in other cases where you create singularities in the affine structure, such as if you have a complex surface and you blow up a point on the intermechanical divisor. So if you do that at the corner of a toric manifold, then of course you're still in the toric world. It's easy. But if you do it at a point that's somehow on an edge of a polytope, then you actually end up creating another one of these singularities in the interior of the affine structure. And there I can analyze the wall crossing and see that it works quite well. And by extension, I think we understand, I should say now I'm working on this with Abu Zaid and Kedzarkov, I think we understand how to blow up prefolds along curves. And there again, I think we can understand exactly how the corrections work out and what the superpotential does after you correct things. In general, I don't know.
Another question from Pennsylvania.